Please note that the following program includes adult themes and language. You're listening to the weekly show on Discourse.
Yeah, I'm back.
Episode 20, Christchurch, with Morgan Nickel. Episode 20, it's a big round number. Most podcasts would probably celebrate by having some kind of rowdy party. Instead, on Discourse, we are breaking the mould by making what I hope you'll find to be the best episode ever. Unfortunately, it's not a very funny one. It's serious business, as this week I'm speaking to a series of people who were caught in the Christchurch earthquake or who have been trying to help with the cleanup, or who have ideas on how to rebuild the city. First up, we have Leighton Duncan, previously on the show in episode 17 when we had an iPhone developer special. This time he's back because he was in the Christchurch CBD when the earthquake happened, causing considerable damage to his office. Leighton speaks to us from Christchurch. I apologise in advance for the poor audio quality in portions of this interview. Most of it's very clean, but some of it is a little bit fuzzy.
Discourse.
Holy fuck, giant earthquake. City is in chaos, buildings down everywhere. Fires, smoke and dust everywhere. Walls peeled away from us in the office. Reports of cathedral down. City is totaled. Leighton, I mean, what happened? You posted up twit pics within, I mean, it seemed like within minutes of your office, and it just looked like a wreck. I mean, what happened?
It seemed like forever, actually, because the Vodafone was down pretty much immediately. So it seemed like at least a few hours after the quake that we managed to get any sort of signal or any, you know, text messages through, and then data was all over the place. So I think that was quite a long time after the actual quake hit.
It felt pretty quick, maybe because it was, you know, so on the scene. And I guess, you know, there was a barrage of media. I mean, it exploded with TV3 kind of getting into the game so quickly. TVNZ, you know, kind of, I guess their Christchurch offices suffered quite heavy damage, so they lost a lot of equipment. But TV3 were on the scene and broadcasting pretty quickly. So maybe my perception is, I mean, I didn't do a lot of work that afternoon. I tell you what, geez, what an incredible event.
I don't think anyone did. I was basically up in our office, which is in an old 1920s sort of era brick warehouse, and we're kind of on the top floor, sort of a three-story building.
Right.
And the general area that we're in is kind of, you know, a really, really old lane precinct, which has been sort of renovated and rejuvenated over the last 10 or so years. And, you know, there's been a lot of earthquake strengthening going into the buildings and stuff like that. And it was unbelievable when this thing hit. It was so immediate. There was no warning rumble that we usually get with, you know, the aftershocks that we had been having from the September quake.
So it just really hit.
It just hit. And, you know, within seconds we knew that this was a big one, and we were running for the door frames to try and get under something sort of solid.
Now, I mean, from seeing the photo, the walls, I mean, you describe them as having peeled away, and it literally looks exactly like that, with the brick walls just kind of twisted curling away. I mean, did door frames feel like any kind of safety? I can't imagine.
The only safety we had. It was kind of the only sort of modern sort of structure in the building. The rest was, you know, exposed brick. Oh, there goes an aftershock.
Oh. Oh, I didn't hear anything.
Just a little one.
Yeah.
What was I saying?
Oh, exposed brick in your office. Now, that's my favorite kind of office space, with that kind of beautiful, you know, fired yellow brick interior facing. And I'm imagining, I've never been to your office, but I'm imagining big, thick wooden beams, kind of rustic.
Yeah, all exposed beams.
And
roof
I love and that stuff.
My memory of when it hit was the first running towards a door. We've got a big 19-inch server rack sort of next to the door, and I could just see that swaying back and forwards. Sort of the top of it was moving at least a meter side to side, and it was just
my website.
it was unbelievable. And then from the door frame, all I could see was the roof moving off the walls and seeing daylight come in between the roof and the walls, and then the walls just literally peeled away. And the roof came down, and it was just a mess.
Bloody hell.
So luckily there was only myself and another guy in the office at the time. Everyone else was sort of out to lunch around the city, so we weren't full. Everyone got out of our building unscathed.
Jeez, what a fluke.
Very lucky. And then, you know, going out into the lane and just seeing the bricks just everywhere. Yeah. All you could see was bricks strewn across the lane. The apartment sort of opposite us, I think 4-story brick building had just, you know, the top portions of that had peeled away.
Yeah.
And just crashed into the lane. And directly opposite our entrance is a C1 cafe. And they obviously have tables on the outside along the lane, and it was just, you know, people just everywhere.
Yeah. Jeez, it must have been. I mean, as scary as it must have been inside, I mean, being outside with those bricks.
Outside was far more terrifying.
Around. And I mean, I saw footage of people, you know, just with terrible bleeding head injuries. And
yep.
I mean, and that would have probably been the minor ones. I mean, people were criticizing. I thought it was actually pretty shitty behavior. People were criticizing TV3 for broadcasting, you know, unedited footage live as it came in because it showed people with injuries. But I'm absolutely certain that they were not showing everything they were seeing.
Oh, absolutely not. It's the one thing that kind of struck me from all the TV coverage is that it looks bad, but the reality is actually...
I mean, I think a lot worse.
Being there is a lot worse.
Yeah, the smell must be terrible. I saw, was it video or was it a photo from the Port Hills of the central city immediately after the quake and the massive cloud of dust.
Yeah.
Someone described it, I think a TV3 news correspondent, described it as being like the Twin Towers dust, but maybe not as thick, which, I mean, that must be, I mean, so this... The earth heaves, it strikes without warning, buildings start falling down around you, the air is thick with, you know, concrete and brick dust. People are getting smashed, there must have been people, you know, walking around in a daze or crying or bleeding.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems like a catastrophe. I've never encountered anything. I mean, I've never even been in a mild earthquake. I have no understanding of, you know, how it must have been.
It's hard to explain sort of how you feel after that when you sort of that sort of scene. It's like I was just literally shaking for, you know, an hour and a half afterwards. It was just, you know, just hard to comprehend what had happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, once we sort of did get outside the building, you could smell. You could actually smell smoke from where we were.
Yeah.
And then once we sort of got into the clear out of the lane area, looking down the road and the CTV building was just, you know, a block from where our office is. And, you know, just seeing that pancake and the smell was just unbelievable. It's just a mixture of ruptured gas mains, so you could smell the natural gas coming. And the, you know, just building material was just the most awful smell. It was just unbelievable.
Yeah, I can't imagine. After, I don't know exactly what the sequence of events was, but it seemed that after the earth had settled a bit, though it sounds like there were aftershocks almost constantly, yeah?
There was some very big aftershocks pretty soon after. There was, you know, bits of buildings coming down at the time. And it was just, you know, people everywhere. And no one really knew what to do. There was, you know, there was this, obviously there was this big earthquake had hit, and people were wandering around some of these buildings and, you know, unaware of, or just not thinking about the fact that, you know, there's going to be aftershocks and there's bits of building falling all over the place. And kind of, you can't think straight in that sort of situation, I guess.
Well, it's so far outside anyone's normal context. I mean, how can you know what to do? What it appears you did is you tried to make your way home. Is that right?
Yeah, pretty much.
And thankfully for many of us, you took the occasional picture as you went and uploaded those.
Yeah. So that was, you know, I walked past a lot of stuff and I was walking towards the CTV building taking a video, and, you know, as soon as I noticed it, it completely pancaked. It just, you know, it didn't feel right taking images of a lot of that stuff.
Well, I mean, it becomes immediately apparent that there must be, I mean, it can't have been survivable.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I think they did get a couple of people out, yeah? But
yeah, I think so.
The lucky ones. I think the last survivor out of that building, I think, was on the first day, wasn't it, on the 22nd?
Yeah, it was virtually straight after the quake that the last people came out of that building, I think. And, you know, there's friends of mine that have been trapped in there.
I'm sorry to hear that.
The managing director of CTV, and he was one of the founders of Magnum Mac.
Yeah.
So I sort of had a lot to do with him over the years from, you know, a very young age. So he was last seen in there by the secretary who just got out of the building. And he was last seen heading up the stairs minutes before the quake hit.
I think I think I saw tweets from people trying to find Murray Wood.
Yeah, so he's obviously presumed dead in there. I don't think they've recovered his body at all. And then one of his long-term employees at Magnum Mac, Stephen Wright, was also in that building. He had just sort of recently left Magnum Mac and joined CTV. He was also, you know, in there at the time as well, and so far unaccounted for.
It feels, I mean, it's just these collapsed structures are so dangerous still that, I mean, I can understand why they need to be careful, but it feels so cruel to not know that there are still so many. I think that there's still at least 50 people who, I mean, they just can't say either way. They don't have any idea where they might be. They don't know if they're in, you know, one of these collapsed buildings, or if they just haven't put their hands up yet, if they're just out of contact.
Yep.
I mean, the waiting, it just must be absolutely appalling for the friends and for the family.
Mm-hmm.
All of my friends in Christchurch have been incredibly lucky. My girlfriend's family came and stayed with us. They flew out as soon as they could. Little girls who I'll play there. I spoke to the girls. They're only about 4 or 5 and about 6 or 7 years old. I'll play their interview next on the show. And they, little girls, they're old. You know, I go from playing in the pool here in my building with them to having a quick chat on the mics. And they're talking about death. Little children. It doesn't seem like it should be something that they experience at that age. It just, I mean, it's nature. What do you do?
Right.
It's I mean, it's not like we have the Nazis to blame.
Yeah.
Although some appallingly pig-headed assholes say that it's because we tolerate gays in our society. And I can't believe the balls on those guys. I mean, there's so much tragedy involved. And for them to try and advance their ridiculously small-minded fringe politics on the back of this It is just so offensive.
It's sick.
It's absolutely sick. And I can only hope that those people are legitimately sick in the head and aren't being cynical in the hope for publicity, because bloody hell. As it goes with publicity, it seemed from your Twitter stream in the day or so afterwards, thanks to the photos that you were uploading, and I saw that you uploaded, I guess, everything that you took in a big zip file.
Yep.
And then almost melted down your server. Because it was so popular, it sounds like off the back of that there was quite a bit of media interest. I saw mentions of CNN, and WABC, and so on. What is it like to be kind of in the middle of this? I mean, such a personal event, you know, with friends missing, and you know, your beautiful office destroyed. You know, trivial things like your office is wrecked, or you can't drink from the tap, and then. I mean, I guess I'm perpetuating the same thing. Having to speak to people about it, I mean, what is it like to be amidst that sort of media? I don't know if it was like a frenzy.
It was difficult because, the phone networks and the data networks around the city were so overloaded that, you know, I wasn't getting a lot inwards. It was kind of me just posting some of the stuff that I had. You know, you weren't able to load Twitter, you weren't able to load websites or anything for hours afterwards, really.
Yeah.
So every now and then, you know, an email would sneak in from, you know, a news agency wanting to use the pictures or wanting to do phone interviews, but there was no way to get phone access in or out of the city, really. It was just gridlock. And so the interviews that I did ended up being sort of much, much later that night, sort of just before midnight, when things had freed up a little bit and the power had literally just come back on, where we were living. But at that point, you know, it was still hard to grasp the scale of it, what had actually happened. So, you know, at that point, I didn't know that that friends were still trapped in the city or anything like that. So it was kind of, it didn't seem personal at that point, I don't think.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it must have been too.
Or as personal.
I mean, I suppose that with a lot of things, you only get perspective when you have some distance.
Yeah.
You know, when you have some time. I think that a lot of New Zealand doesn't understand how big this is, even now.
It's hard because, you know, you watch the stuff on the TV and it is not at all, you know, a full indication of what happened, I don't think.
Yeah. And I don't think there's an understanding of how long it's going to take. It's probably too early to really be talking about reconstruction, but there's a lot of people there. The infrastructure needs to be back and, you know, people need a place to work and to live. So there does need to be rebuilding. And we're going to speak later on in the show about that a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that most of New Zealand understands how huge an effort that's going to be.
I think we're really lucky over, you know, I live on the west side of the city, sort of 4 kilometres from the centre of the city, and I think we're extremely lucky out here with the state of things. Power came back pretty quickly. We only sort of lost water here temporarily.
Yeah.
You know, it was back by about 4 o'clock that day, although we're only sort of a kilometre from the nearest aquifer well.
Yeah.
So we're kind of lucky, but, you know, you go even 5 kilometres towards the other side of the town, and it's just, you know, roads are unrecognizable. It's just silt and stuff everywhere. It's just, you know, it is literally like a war zone. And you see, you know, convoys of army trucks rolling in the city. It's just unbelievable.
That liquefaction is incredible.
It is. And it's, you know, I could go a couple hundred meters from my house and there will be, you know, a foot of liquefaction, whereas there's nothing here. And it's just, you know, certain patches. Although, you know, the further east you go, definitely the more impact that has. It's everywhere and it's just totally destroyed infrastructure and roads, and there's no way you could drive a normal car through a lot of those areas. It's just, you know, holes and piles of silt absolutely everywhere.
Yeah. So you have water, but you can't drink it. Is that right? You have to boil it.
Yeah.
I take it you're probably not allowed to use the toilet still.
No, you can use the toilet, but only sort of certain areas where, you know, there's no obvious signs of
so they've
broken kind of sewers or anything.
So they've gone through and they've kind of checked the sewer mains in some areas already and
Well, what they're saying is if you can flush your toilet and there's, you know, no obvious signs of broken sewer pipes around your property or on the road, then it's probably a good thing to do. It sort of helps them identify
right.
where the breaks are, and they can you know, start looking at repairing that. But, you know, the scale of it is just immense.
It sounds like you were very lucky.
Very lucky where I live, yeah.
And where you work. I mean, those photos are no joke.
No, not at all.
The state of it's Poplar Lane. The state of the whole lane, I mean, it looks like bombs have gone off along there.
Yeah, and that's not even, you know, that's not the worst of it. You go to the corner of the block that we're on, and there's a, you know, the ANZ building is totally flattened, you know, an old four-story brick building, apartments in the top. And
is that the one with the dome, the little?
Yes, yeah.
Right. Oh, I remember that one well. It was beautiful. I've only been to Christchurch a few times, but I absolutely adore that inner city. It's probably one of my favourite inner cities in all of New Zealand. Combine that maybe with Wellington's waterfront, and that would probably just about be my ideal city.
And it's lying in ruins.
Yeah. How do you feel now about these heritage buildings?
Well, I think my opinion of that has definitely changed.
Yeah.
You know, after the September quake, I was very much in favour of trying to recover as many of those buildings as possible. But, you know, you see what happened on Tuesday, and it's just there's no way that they can stay standing. It's just, you know, far too dangerous.
Yeah.
And I don't know anyone that was in the city when that hit that would want to ever go back into a building like that. No one ever expected Christchurch to be the site of the next big earthquake.
I always thought it would be Wellington.
Everyone thought it would be Wellington, yeah. And it, you know, just hit out of the blue.
After the September earthquakes, I remember your you had a little bit of damage to your office. And, I mean, it looked fine once they kind of pinned it back together with a bit of angle iron or something. But,
yep.
I mean, clearly that was completely inadequate. I mean, everything just peeled away, right?
Well, that bit stayed up, I think.
Oh, really? Oh, no. If only they'd done a more thorough job.
So it kind of did the job.
Right. So what should be done with the reconstruction? Have you lived in Christchurch your whole life?
Yep, I've lived here my whole life, so, you know.
So what should be built there? I mean, one of my favourite buildings in Christchurch, aside from, you know, all the various, you know, beautiful old buildings which are probably gone now, is certainly the gallery. I rate that probably as my favourite gallery in New Zealand.
Absolutely, yeah.
But, I mean, I also love that across the road is the Art Centre, which is
the old Gothic revival architecture, yeah.
Right. Which, I mean, and I think that kind of, that very modern stone and glass and steel look of the gallery is really offset when it's put next to, you know, the villas and the old art centre and the museum across the road, or, you know, just up the road. They go together so well. What would a city that was, you know, entirely made up of those, you know, very modern glass and steel buildings, what would that look like? Would that be human? Would that be livable? I mean, is it warm or is it cold?
I know what you mean. That's kind of the thing that I've been thinking about a bit is, you know, what is the, you know, the city is known for its sort of English feel, and the vast majority of those buildings are going to be, well, they're already gone or will be demolished.
Yeah.
And how do you retain that sort of feel?
Do you fake it with you know, the Auckland-style facadism?
Exactly. Or do you even attempt to do that? Or do you go the glass and steel modern way? I'm sure when they, you know, they rebuilt Napier, that they didn't think that the architecture that they were building at the time would become iconic. So I think it's hard to look at architecture today and say that it's going to be distinctive of this time. It's definitely one of my concerns about the city is the rebuild and how it's going to be done. Is it going to be, you know, cheap tilt slab rubbish and just become a ghetto?
Yeah.
Or is it, you know, are they going to take the opportunity to actually
build
replan
like
the city and build something, you know, truly great?
Yeah.
And I just hope that someone takes charge of that and you know, owns it and does the city justice.
Yeah.
It would be the death of the city if, you know, there was that sort of total unplanned, ultra cheap construction.
Yeah.
happen, it would totally kill the city.
I worry that modern developers will hear cash registers going off in their heads, and they'll just go for that really cheap, really quick tilt slab construction, and it will just be a disaster. Have you put any thought into moving, or are you, you know,
no?
I mean, you've lived there your whole life, so it's your only home, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, I've kind of travelled a bit through the states and various areas, and you know, always come back to Christchurch is the place that I want to live. You know, it's close to the city, close to the mountains, close to everything you need, and it's a good life. So,
Leighton, thank you so much for joining us. I know that it is obviously it's very difficult to talk about a lot of this, I know that our listeners will really appreciate it. Thank you for coming on the show again.
No problem.
Thanks once again for speaking to us, Leighton. Next up, we have a pair of Christchurch students who were also caught in the quake. They are sisters Louisa and Ella.
Discourse.
I understand, are you a geology student?
No, I'm a school student and I do math, reading, spelling.
Same.
Into the microphone,
math.
Ella.
Math, same.
You also do that?
I go to school now.
And I
can't. But you are.
And morning tea and lunch.
Morning tea and lunch, but you are earthquake experts, I think. Is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now you're at earthquake experts because why?
Because we know what to do.
Yeah.
What do you do?
You go on the floor. If you jump down, you have to test if it's a long one or short.
How do you know the difference?
Because you see, it goes shorter, you stand up, and if it goes harder, you go down the floor or you make a real run to the next doorway.
It's fascinating. This makes absolutely no sense to me because I've never been in an earthquake. So I don't understand what it feels like at all.
It feels like you're wobbling side to side and you're being crushed by a meteorite.
I know what it feels like to wobble side to side, but being crushed by a meteorite, that doesn't sound very good. So why are you in Auckland? Is it because it was so fun in Christchurch?
No, because we don't have any electricity, water.
You don't have water or electricity? But how do you play with the internet?
We don't even play with it.
I would feel like a junkie with no fix. Do you know what that's like?
No.
Have you ever tried heroin?
What are you talking about? We had to go to the toilet in the potty loo.
In the potty loo? Well, that sounds all right. It's probably quite a good experience.
Excuse me, it's not. You have to stand outside in front of everybody on the toilet.
Okay, well, that doesn't sound good. I don't like that. Why didn't you...
Where do we have to go for
poos? Into a hole.
A poo in a hole? Like some kind of barbarian. A little birdie told me that you fell down the hole.
Yeah.
Oh.
Nearly.
Was that fun?
No.
No. So in Auckland, what we have is hot water and showers and all the cartoons you can drink.
What?
Well, I'm just trying to suggest that maybe this is a better place to be.
Yeah. Then a wobbling town being crushed by a meteorite.
No, no wobbling, no crushing, no meteorites.
Well, people got crushed in an earthquake.
I know, I've heard about that. It's terrible. Yeah, it's no fun, eh?
Yeah. There hasn't been a single rescue since Wednesday.
Test over.
It's not a test.
What is it?
Well, it's quite hard in an earthquake. And I think you know how hard it is. No water, no internet, no anything it feels like. And you just have to do serious things. You got to cope with the death and everything else.
I like Christchurch, but not now. Because the earthquake happened, and it was really scary.
I bet it was. So, when are you going back to Christchurch? Are you afraid of going back to the city?
Yeah, kind of, but it's only going to be in 10 days, so I think I'll be over by then.
I hope that's right.
So, are you pleased to be visiting Auckland?
Yeah, to get out of the earthquakes. Yep. Yep.
And what have you been doing since you've been here?
I've been
eating chips.
Yeah, what she said, watching TV and going swimming, and I really want to go swimming now.
Is that your way of saying you don't want to talk to the show anymore and you'd like to go to the pool?
Kind of.
Yeah.
Louisa and Ella, thank you for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Discourse. I'd also like to thank their mum, Nikki, for letting the girls talk to the show.
You're listening to Discourse.
Next, we speak with a friend of the show, David Frampton. He was also on episode 17, the iPhone app developer special. This is his third appearance on the show. Unfortunately, this time he joins us because even though he was in Wellington when the quake happened, his mother was caught in the collapse of the Pine Gould Guinness building in central Christchurch.
Yeah, she was actually on level 3.
About an hour after the quake struck, you said, "Mum was in the CBD. Haven't heard back from her yet." And then not long after that, after we started to see photos of the PGG building kind of collapsed, you said, "That is my mum's building."
Yeah, well, because I didn't know where she worked. And in fact, she travels a lot. So I wasn't sure even if she was in the CBD.
Yeah.
So initially I texted mum and I texted my stepdad, Graham, just to try to, you know, find out if they're even there in Christchurch.
Yeah.
And I didn't hear back from mum, obviously, and I thought, well, you know, maybe her phone's off or whatever. But then I did hear back from Graham saying, yes, that she was in the CBD. So, you know, at that point I started getting a little bit worried because he hadn't heard back from her either. But we still didn't know what building. And so as we sort of, you know, we were watching the news and we saw the building on, you know, the PGG building on the TV and thought, wow, you know, that just looked like it would be not many people getting out alive.
Yeah.
And then we sort of looked into where mum's work was based and saw that it was in that building.
Yeah.
And that was a bit of a tough time because, you know, we hadn't heard back from her. We knew that she was in that building and we'd seen it on TV. And at one point they actually flew a helicopter over the top and we saw the live footage as they're showing it. And, you know, we just broke up basically because we couldn't see how she could possibly get out alive from that point.
I couldn't see it either. I mean, I didn't work at all that afternoon because, I mean, I think probably a lot of people didn't work that day.
Yeah.
Just because everyone had friends or family in the city. I can't imagine what it was like for you. Even, I mean, we knew quite quickly that my girlfriend's family was safe, but I can't imagine what it was like for you seeing that footage you tweeted, watching the helicopter footage on TV3, struggling to maintain hope. Optimistic fool that I am, after seeing an earlier interview with someone who got out quite early, said that you know, there were large cavities inside, because that's what he said. It was I mean, I didn't want to give anyone false hope, but
we were you know, none of us ever said, you know, well, it looks, you know, like she's not coming out or anything.
Yeah.
Like that. We always did maintain some hope, you know. But yeah, as time went on and we still hadn't heard from her, and certainly overnight, you know, hearing nothing through the night, we were just waiting for a phone call basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, every time the phone rang, our hearts dropped basically, and we were just not sure what we were going to hear.
It sounds like probably a lot of the time when that phone was ringing, it was probably the media, was it? Trying to get the story?
Yeah, we didn't have to deal too much with the media. Graham certainly got a lot of phone calls. I got a bunch of emails, and yeah, basically didn't reply to most of them after a while. It was just sort of, I mean, it was too soon because we didn't know yet.
Yeah.
We knew nothing. And but then, I mean, yeah, so it was about 11:30 the next day.
Yeah.
We finally got a phone call, and you know, we were expecting the worst, but actually, you know, it was the best news that we could have hoped for.
Yeah.
You know, she was alive and unharmed. Which was just amazing. You know, she was coherent and talking to the rescuers and didn't have any injuries.
It's incredible good fortune. Was your mother the last one out of the building?
Yeah, I think she still is at this point. Yeah, actually the last one found alive.
Yeah. Bloody hell.
Yeah, which is really, really terrible because, you know, everyone kind of expected more, really.
Now, so when you visited Christchurch, I imagine, was that quite brief? You just kind of arrived, you know, got together with your family and then went to Otago. Did you have a chance to look around the city at all?
We did go on one day, yeah. We drove into the CBD because, well, not into the cordoned area, but we actually, because Mum and Graham did an interview with 60 Minutes, and how they did that was to actually let us all meet the people who rescued her in a bar in Christchurch.
Right. That must have been really nice.
Oh, it was fantastic, yeah. It's just, there was about a dozen guys from New South Wales who had pulled her out and, you know, had done all the drilling and kind of getting to her. So, yeah, it was just great to be able to thank them in person.
It's incredible and it's heartwarming and it's rewarding that so many members of, you know, the international community, which I guess we can call it the international community now more than ever, have been so keen and happy and ready and able to help. I mean, yeah. Offers from Israel, we've got rescue crews from Japan and I think the Philippines and like Central America and the US, and I think we've got Canadians, we've got lots of Australians, and I think I've felt like it was kind of New Zealand's job to be the helper in these situations. We would send, you know, what Navy we had. We would send our firefighters over to New South Wales and so on. And we would send, you know, support and help. And, I mean, I kind of got a little bit, now this is kind of a, maybe it's a bit of a shocking revelation. I kind of got a bit tired of always being the guys that helped. And I was a bit outspoken about, you know, the whole thing with the floods around Brisbane, you know, saying, you know, why is it that we are having to help, you know, a country that's richer than us with, you know, I felt like it was, you know, why should we be helping? Why should we be funding, you know providing, you know, donations to them when, you know, they're a bigger, wealthier country? I take everything I said. And I can't take it back hard or fast enough because, I mean, what a stink guy I turned out to be when, I mean, it's just, you know, everyone helping out where and when they can. And it's just through the grace of, you know, natural chance, coincidence, whatever, that we weren't hit by, you know, Boxing Day tsunamis and we weren't hit by, you know, massive firestorms. And it's clear now, it's clear to me, maybe it was already clear to everyone else, that everyone should always help wherever they can, never begrudge it. And never,
yeah, I mean, when we were, you know, waiting to hear any news of Mum, you know, we're watching on TV and hearing about all these teams that were coming over.
Yeah.
And just knowing that, you know, these countries, these weren't just any old guys that were sending over. These were their best, yeah. You know, rescue teams.
Yeah.
You know, they can pick, you know, hand chosen from a bunch of different, you know, groups, the yeah. paramedics, the, you know, firefighters and just a huge range of people.
Yeah.
And all put together, and you know they sent their best people out, and so I knew that the best people in the world were there,
yeah.
Searching for my mum. So,
I try to hide it well, but I'm a giant crybaby sook. And when I saw the photos of the Americans getting ready to fly over, and how pro they were like, you know, special forces SWAT team of rescue workers. And it was just obvious that they were the pros. They had the best gear that you can possibly get. And they were getting yep. ready to come and help us. It yep. was just, it was such an incredible moment to realize that people cared. People everywhere on earth cared. And they cared enough to not just give us time, but to risk their lives. Because, I mean, we've got to be honest, these people are going into very dangerous situations in some of these structures, right? It's not just about fire, but, I mean...
Yeah, that's very real.
There are
real
still... risk. There's still, you know, stuff coming down. Well, maybe not today. I don't know if there still is today, but, I mean, there are ongoing, quite large aftershocks. And then you get idiots on the internet moaning that, you know, no one went into the cathedral and started clearing up the rubble and there when... I mean, it's just, it's so precarious. It's so dangerous. I mean, if you go in there, you're going to, you know, there's a pretty good chance that you're going to get squashed. And I mean, these armchair quarterbacks saying, I mean, okay, so if you think that you've got loved ones in the cathedral, okay, I can understand your desire to know. Of course, I mean, that waiting must be, and I'm sure you know this, David, I'm sure you can tell me and tell the listeners how terrible it must be just to not know. But you still, yep. you have to let the rescuers, you have to let them take the time that they need to be safe themselves, because we don't need more people being
yeah,
injured
absolutely.
There.
Well, I mean, when they were pulling Mum out of the building, there was a quite large aftershock just as they were pulling her basically through the hole, putting her onto the ladder.
Yeah.
So, you know, at any time during the rescue, it could have all gone pear-shaped, basically. Yeah. But you know, there's a huge risk there that the rescuers could get caught, and you know, they do put their lives on the line, but sometimes the risks are just too great.
I heard Danny Watson, someone posted a link to a letter that he read that he had received from, I think, an ambulance worker, talking about the absolute horror show, just the dreadful things that, you know, he was seeing and having to try and, you know, help people survive who, you know, ultimately could not, you know, trying to stabilize people who, I think one person... There have been people who have been rescued by, you know, having to amputate their crushed, trapped limbs. But there are others who have been, you know, they've had the amputations, but it's been too late, or they'd already, you know, they were already too weak. And just the stories coming from those rescue workers are absolutely horror show. And yet they're going back in there every day. And so, I mean, to see these small-minded little fuckheads on the internet, you know, criticizing them, it was pretty terrible. So did you have a chance to talk to your mother's rescuers?
Yes, I did. Yep. Yeah. I mean, I was just a kind of a bit of a bumbling mess, really. I was just kind of, thank you. You know, that's it.
I'm sure that's really gratifying for them.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, they were saying they usually, you know, I mean, the vast majority of people that they've rescued, they haven't been able to meet them. You know, they get put in an ambulance and away they go, and that's the end of it. So they were actually quite glad to talk with Mum as well. And, you know, just saying that she helped out a lot with her own rescue and kind of, you know, told them what they were doing wrong and stuff as well, which is quite funny. It was just really, really good. I mean, feel lucky just to have been able to do that too. Yeah.
That's really great. But,
I mean, we're always, it's a little bit hard because, you know, we're looking at what's going on with everyone else as well. You know, there's obviously others who haven't been nearly as lucky as us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, for us, we're so filled with joy, but then just we know what it feels like to be waiting, and there's still people waiting, you know. And we waited 24 hours, and it was horrible. Yeah. It was just really, really horrible. But my heart goes out to these other people who are in worse situations and still waiting. It's just terrible.
I mean, when we record now, it's Tuesday, we've just had the, an hour or two ago, we've just had the moment of silence around the country, and there are still, I think the news says there's still at least 50 people unaccounted for. I mean, how terrible must it be to be those families? I can't imagine it. I've never been through anything like this. Hopefully I never have to, and hopefully you never have to go through it again either.
Yeah, I hope so too.
I think once is more than enough. Once is far more than enough. So shortly on the show, we'll be talking with John Ballinger about his Christchurch garage sale site, which is raising funds for the Red Cross. I note that you also are playing your part in terms of, you know, they're trying to do some fundraising with appappeal.co.nz. Can you tell me something about that?
A few of us Kiwi developers kind of got together, I think organized by Joss from She and Pickpock Games. But we got together and decided that we'd donate the proceeds from the sales of our apps for a week to the Red Cross. So
Jesus, Chopper 2's proceeds for a week must be a pretty hefty sort of a donation.
Well, yeah, I mean, I want to donate anyway, so I thought this was quite a good way to do it. So it means that people can kind of help out by just, you know, buying Chopper 2 or any of the other apps there, and we'll donate the proceeds. I mean, Apple will take their 30%, but 70% of the profits will be going straight to the Red Cross. So,
probably not the most important question, but do you have any idea what the total is so far?
No, I'm not sure. I mean, I know Chopper 2's, you know, thousands of dollars will be going for just on Chopper 2's part. Yeah. So it should be a sizable donation.
Yeah, it's a really, I mean, it's a great idea. It's great to see people, you know, just doing whatever they can. And this also looks like it is going to the Red Cross.
Yeah.
There are international developers who've also kicked in.
Yeah. I haven't been able to follow exactly what's going on here with it. I did see that there were some international developers.
Oh, mobile photos. Carl's kicked in his apps as well. Wow, there's lots of really good apps on here. All right, listeners, you've got until Saturday. Go to appappeal.co.nz and just get all of them. Get all of them. Come on now. They're only like $1 each. Get them all. It's going to a good cause. You get, you know, some of the greatest apps in the world, because they are, by definition, they're wonderful because they're from Kiwi developers. And the Red Cross, you know, benefits as well. Why wouldn't you? just go and do it. appappeal.co.nz. So are you still in, you're still in Otago now? You haven't moved back to Wellington or Christchurch?
Yeah, we're just staying here for the next week or so, just to stay with Mum and kind of, yeah. I mean, yeah, we're all just so happy here, so. Yeah.
I imagine that at this time particularly, you probably don't want to let her too far out of your sight.
No, we're trying to talk her out of going back to Christchurch, but I'm not sure whether we're going to succeed. She's definitely considering. Well, yeah, they'll be back there soon.
Probably. Is Christchurch her home city, or
they've been there for a few years now? But we're sort of she's been based in Dunedin mostly and Wellington as well. But,
right.
Yeah, we're certainly trying to talk her into moving up north.
I really appreciate that you've joined us on the show. I know that, your story is, it must have been absolutely grueling, but it's such a great result. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, and I thank you for having me. It's been a tough week, but as I said, we're one of the lucky ones. And
Go and give your mum a kiss and tell her you love her.
Yeah.
All right?
Will do.
And I think that probably everyone should give their mum a kiss if your mum's around. If not, find a loved one and give them a kiss. Maybe give me a kiss if you can't find anyone else. I don't mind. I'm easy.
You're listening to Discourse.
Next up on the show, we have Nat Talkington. He's an old school web guy, about as old school as you get in New Zealand. He is widely known to have built the very first website in New Zealand. And he also runs the Foo Camp, which is an unconference held annually in Warkworth. Nat's joining us to speak about eq.org.nz. Well, I suppose you can probably introduce it pretty well, Nat.
Sure. So when the earthquake hit Christchurch, there was a lot of information floating around Twitter, and it was pretty hard to get a feeling for the destruction that people were talking about. They were posting photos, but you didn't know where in the city those photos were taken. I mean, they would give you an address, but like that means anything to somebody who's not from Christchurch. Mm. So we used a website called CrowdMap to put those photos online to correlate the descriptions of destruction and what had fallen down and where there was water and who had lost power and those kinds of things. A whole bunch of volunteers basically got together on the spot and started processing those messages and putting them online. And then we realized that CrowdMap site totally could not deal with being the central point of focus for everybody who wanted to know what was going on in Christchurch. And so it's running on open source software. So we brought up a website based on that, fully scalable and able to deal with the load. And somehow it all sort of grew from there into, we now have a volunteer organization that is running around the clock from five or six different countries, processing Twitter messages, reports from people on the ground, scanning official information sites, and bringing all that information together in a one-stop shop for the people of Christchurch and anybody on the outside who's interested as well. So we tell you things like, here's where there's water available, here was the opening hours of this ATM, this supermarket is shut, this one is open, and here are its hours. All of that kind of information is available on the site.
Yeah, it looks like it's a beautiful Google map when you arrive with a bunch of, a heat map or something.
Points of interest, those ones. That wouldn't be a heat map. But yes, lots and lots of points. So we're tracking, I think, over 800, maybe you're up to 900 now, different points around the city. So as messages come in, the status on those points change, you know, as places get power or lose power or have water or don't have water. For example, in the early days when shelters were open and then some of the shelters closed again because they were full up, you know, we were tracking all of that information and putting it on the web page.
I saw the CrowdMap version. The current one is...
We swapped it out pretty bloody quick. So it's running on eq.org.nz, which is a domain we registered so that it would have a permanent address separate from that site.
Mm. Yeah, it's a great domain. And that was available still.
How you'd be surprised at the ones that were available. I also registered disaster.net.nz, happened to be floating around.
Now, I saw something called Crisis Camp. Is that how they're being
Yes.
Loaded?
So that software, that's open source software underneath it all, is Ushahidi. It's Swahili for testimony. And it's a software that was developed during a set of elections in, I can't remember the African country. Let's say it's Kenya. Mm. And people on the ground were suspicious that there was corruption. So they reported people being turned away from the polls, that kind of thing. Mm. They let people report in those kinds of things through their cell phone and then entered it on a map so you could see at a glance the extent of the dodgy behavior. And that software to let people report things that are then put onto a map is what is behind CrowdMap and is what we installed on eq.org.nz.
Are you sure that election wasn't in the US? Because that sounds like their experience with elections.
Yes, the US totally needs the software as well. So it's been used in the Haiti earthquake. It's been used in US blizzard response. Generally, anywhere where there's a lack of good official information collected in one place, where user-contributed reports are coming thick and fast and are providing more context than the officials are giving.
Well, it looks like it's working really bloody well.
It's stunning. It's been incredible to be on the inside of this. I mean, I'm not the kingpin at all. The whole thing is the idea of Tim McNamara, who is a Wellingtonian who had been to a gathering of Webby emergency response people at a crisis camp in New Zealand. And he had sort of, there had been a meeting and they talked about this. And then when the emergency happened, everybody who had been at that meeting flew off to be emergency response people on the ground. And so there was nobody to actually pick it up and run with it. Mm. So Tim brought together these volunteers, people who just put their hand up and said, oh, yeah, I'll handle the technology. You know, people like Rob Coop and Nigel McNee and Brenda Wallace, who sort of stepped forward to make that happen. Mm. And then we had all these volunteers who had to process the reports, because we've done hundreds of thousands of Twitter messages, emails, forms, SMSs, all that kind of stuff have been seen by the system. And every single one has been seen by a volunteer, decided whether it's the right type of stuff for the site. It has to be associated with the location. So you can't just say, don't swim in the water. That's not, I mean, it's a good message, but yeah, it's not one that we can associate with a point on a map. So our software just can't cope with that stuff. So a volunteer's had to see every single one. And we've had over 100 volunteers put their hands up and say, yeah, I'll give you hours of my time. Mm. It's been really, really, it's returned my faith in humanity.
That is an experience that I've had out of the whole event, actually, where as I've mentioned earlier in the show, I mean, I felt like New Zealand was constantly giving and constantly helping everyone else. And this disaster has made it clear that, you know, it just wasn't our turn. And everyone wants to help us as well, right? Like the entire international community actually is living up to that name.
Absolutely. And the support from around the globe in filtering these messages. I mean, when we go to sleep at 10 o'clock at night, and we've stopped, the volunteers in New Zealand stop about 8 or 9, and we've got Europeans who come on, we've got Americans who follow them, and then we pick it back up in the morning. And it's just incredible to see folks in Seattle, people in Switzerland. You know, you can barely point to a place on the globe where there's not somebody who's helping us. It's really been quite fabulous. And the response here in New Zealand, I mean, you have to say, has been terrific as well. The companies who employ these volunteers have said, no, you go ahead and do this stuff. So we've had somebody from a high-powered law firm. We've had, Catalyst IT in Wellington put on 10, 15 people to process the reports at the very start when we were all firing up and it was starting to swamp. The volunteers who had stepped forward, they said, hey, we'll pay these folks for their time, but they can go and work on this stuff and clear it. They've paid for developers. They've really given above and beyond the call of duty. They're just stellar. But a lot of the volunteers are self-employed or in startups. And, when they work these 12, 15-hour days cutting code and tracking down bugs and improving the software, that's a significant opportunity cost for them. There's a big pain in their life that they're causing, because it's, startups and self-employed people, we're living on the edge of financial success and ruin all the time, walking that tight line. And this kind of thing, I've had to tell people, hey, you need to stop and take care of your life, because, you're no good to us if you go bankrupt or if your family falls apart. You have to take time off and go back and see them.
I think you can see that dedication that they put into it and the quality of the information that's up there. Have you got any stats or any rough idea of the ratio of Christchurch locals, people who are living in the disaster area, versus interested outsiders who are looking at the site?
The best numbers we've been able to have is that it's roughly 50-50. That was the last I heard. It may have changed, which means that we're getting a lot of people from outside interested, but we've also had a lot of folks on the ground digging in.
Yeah. Well,
for a while we were also the conduit to the student volunteer army. We have a short code which the three telcos very kindly made free, and the Catalyst are shouldering the bill for operating, and so. We've been taking all the requests for, you know, I need help at such and such an address, shoveling silt off my driveway and putting that into the student volunteer system. And we finally got it switched over so that they're getting them direct now. But for the longest time, we were processing all their requests as well.
That's a lot of people on the ground.
That's a hell of a lot of people on the ground, yes. They've been fabulous to work with. You know, they're doing amazing work, and it was great to be able to help them.
So it seems like this, I mean, the site was up quickly. I mean, I don't actually remember a time when it wasn't up. And it seems like it has been really central to a lot of work.
Yes. So what we did, we were coming out of, you know, Webstock and Food Camp and a bunch of events that were gathering together the tech community. And we, almost all of the people who are deep into this knew each other through those events. And so when one of us, you know, when Tim said, I want to do this, Rob and I both saw that. The people who saw my responses joined in as well. People who saw Rob's came in too. And so we sort of built up that crowd from these relationships that we'd built at events earlier on, which was it was kind of cool. I mean, I run Kiwi Food Camp, which is an unconference where there's no agenda. I invite people who I think are strong and world capable, and you know, I put together a mix of people, but I don't have an agenda. I don't say, and this is what's going to come out of it. You know, we are building the internet's response team to disasters. And yet, when something happened, they had all the connections they needed to make that work. So we, instead of going off and starting a whole bunch of separate sites, they knew each other and could work together to work on one. And in the early days, there were a bunch of newspapers who wanted to go off and do their own thing. And we were able to talk to them and say, no, look, it's actually better for the folks on the ground if there's one source of information and not three. And they totally bought that. Major props to them for respecting that. Mm-hmm. You know, we knew the Trade Me folks from that. It was just so incredible to have that support. And then when we had a hack day on the weekend where we said, okay, we need a new front end for the site because the standard one is, well, for a start, it's ugly, but two, it's also hiding the functionality of the site and it making it difficult for people to figure out what to do. So we reskinned it. Recently, we've made a new mobile interface to it. I mean, the Ushahidi folks are getting a considerably better piece of software back than they gave us at the start of this disaster. It's been amazing to see.
Right, so you're contributing code back to their...
Oh, totally. It's all in GitHub and all open sourced and ready for them to take and use as they want.
That's great.
It was incredible to see that normally when you think of these sort of open source volunteer projects like this, you think of coders getting in there, and it's people who are systems hackers and database freaks and all that kind of stuff. It was awesome to get the usability crowd in as well for that hack day and say, look, the usability of the site sucks. Fix it for us, please. And they had, you know, we had a pile of volunteers within an hour. They came together on Saturday and worked together. We had mock-ups and wireframes, and then they built the code and we deployed it. It was just absolutely fantastic to see, really heartwarming. It stretched beyond, you know, we found a way for people to give who weren't just coders with a shell open.
Mm. And it looks good. You can tell that a lot of work's been put into it. Something else that is, I mean, speaking of, you know, the bigger, the conventional media people playing along, I see that the TVNZ's developers have just managed to tie EQorg NZ into Teletext, page 700.
Yeah, we had some food campers were starting to make noises about that and say, hey, there's some places that, you know, that don't get the information that's on the site that maybe they should get, and started to reach out to TVNZ, and ta-da, look at that. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, it's hot stuff. I can't say that.
Well, I mean, it's hard to say that Teletext is hot stuff, let's be.
Well, no, it's cool, though. And it's nice for people who knows, their computer fell on the ground and broke. And
yeah, it's a bit like making an Atari 800 version of it. It's
if someone's going to, and they weren't going to do anything else to help, then, you know. Sometimes the thought does count.
In the case of Teletext, that's about all there is, I'm afraid. Not to be so down on it, but it's I don't think it's as going to have as big an impact as the website.
Oh, no, of course not. I mean, the Twitter tie-in must have a vastly bigger impact, I think, than Teletext.
It's amazing. Presumably you've been talking about this earlier as well, but the depth and breadth of information available on what people are tweeting with #NZEQ, it's just incredible.
Yeah, we've spoken to and CHCH and all the other various ones. It's so fragmented. The tweets have been banal and dramatic.
And that's exactly what the experience on the ground is. You know, you've got the incredible drama there, but then you also have to just, you know, you worry about where water is coming from.
Can I flush the toilet?
And there's people who are that every once in a while I get to look in at the messages that come in, the reports that come in from people. And it's just so wonderful where they say, you know, there's a well open on the corner of these two streets. That represents somebody who's sharing water for a start.
Yeah.
And then it's somebody who's sharing the information and saying, you know, come all ye, this is going to make your lives better. Come do it. There's no selfishness or laziness in this.
Who knew?
That was really, really warming.
Who knew that so many people had boreholes? I mean, seriously, who has one in a city? I mean, there's all these artesian wells all over the place, as it turns out. And some of the photos are you know, brilliant with people jerry-rigging PVC piping together to, you know, have a continuous flow of water out on the footpath and a little bench and, you know, people walking along with buckets and bottles and away you go. I mean, it's absolutely brilliant. And I hate to think what would happen in Auckland in a similar event, because I just don't think Auckland has wells like that.
No, I don't know who else does. Perhaps I've been living in a cave, but none of the places I've ever lived have had a well. You know, I'm living out in the country now. It's the first place that has a bore, but it's, you know, electrically driven. So if the poo hit the fan, I'd be knackered.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we all would be. Well, I think it's a beautiful sight. Do you still need volunteers?
It can't hurt to put your name down, because people are, you know, dropping off and coming on all the time. So it'd be lovely if you have, you know, an hour a day, 3 hours a day, whatever you have to give, we'd love to have it. That's volunteer.eq.org.nz. And the next stage is actually to send Tim down to Christchurch and make stronger contact with the emergency services down there for the information they can give us, and make contact with the charities who are on the ground, who exist to support people in situations like this, so that eventually they can run eq.org.nz and not us.
I do like that it's kind of a generic domain which can be used for, you know, future you know, disasters. Thank you for joining us on the show.
Thank you.
Now, we may have been a bit glib about the Teletext hookup in that conversation, but of course Teletext is still quite popular with elderly and deaf people, so this could very well make a difference to some of the more vulnerable people in the disaster zone. And I think it is, I mean, look at Teletext. How impressive is it? Not very, but I think it's pretty great that TVNZ have, you know, the skill on hand to be able to tie, you know, a very modern website into Teletext. You know, as glib as we may have been about it, it's pretty impressive.
You're listening to Discourse.
Now joining us for the first time on the show, but probably not the last, is Auckland web and software developer John Ballinger, who built the fundraising site GarageSaleCHCH.org. Are you there, John?
Yes, hello.
Now tell me about the site. Where did the idea come from? How did you manage to get it up so quickly? Because it seemed to be up there in no time. And how's it going?
Oh, it's going amazing. The idea came about, I suppose I was just going to sleep one night and I was thinking, hey, I should really try and raise some money. There was a couple of websites doing all radio shows saying, text this number and you'll donate $3 to the Red Cross. And I'm thinking, well, you know, how many people are going to do that? And I thought, you know, how can you add more value to the Red Cross, and how can people actually donate more? So I was thinking, oh, I wouldn't mind getting rid of some of my stuff. I had some headphones lying around and an old mouse, and I've got a Mac Mini that I didn't use. And I was thinking, hey, maybe I can get rid of these. And I was thinking, if I put those on Trade Me and sold them, I thought, hey, that'd be a good idea. I wonder if I can convince my other friends to do this. And then I think the idea came from that. So I created the website using something called Google App Engine, which is pretty quick to do it. It's a, sort of a one-page website.
Yeah.
And I spent about 3 days and a couple nights on that as well. And then by Saturday morning, it was all ready to go. And launched it Saturday. And then by today, which is about 48 hours, There's over $4,000 worth of donations on their website ready to go to the Red Cross once items have sold.
I see that there's been 27 items listed already.
Oh, correct. Yeah.
I see that the goal is really ambitious, $100,000.
Yeah. I was thinking, I was going to set it at $10,000, but I think we would have made that in a couple of days. And I was thinking maybe 50, but I think 100,000 is the goal to go for. It's going to take maybe a little bit longer, but I think if we get enough people behind this and enough items listed, that I think we'll make the $100,000 goal. If not, we'll miss only by a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going
to fingers crossed. I hope that would be a great goal anyway.
Yeah. You're going to blow through the $10,000. No problem, I'm sure. And yeah. I mean, this is not a disaster that is going to be fixed overnight. So, I mean, I think that we're going to need to be opening our wallets for a little while.
Yeah, exactly. And I think I was thinking about it tonight as I was going for my run. I was thinking this website can pretty much just sit there autonomously.
Yeah.
And hopefully get other people encouraged to do the same thing when they buy these goods. They go, actually, you know, maybe I should sell some stuff on this website and help the people of Christchurch as well.
So have you TradeMe involved directly? Have you spoken to them directly? I see that there's an email charities at TradeMe.co.nz listed.
Correct. So I talked to it was Phil and a guy from – I was actually Mod from Mods Motors is one of the contacts that I got from a friend. Mm. But another guy I was talking to, Phil, he runs he's the head of the community, the TradeMe community.
Right.
And the forums there, I've spoken to with him, and basically he says that if we can prove that the goods are being donated to charities, TradeMe will refund the success fee.
Oh, that's nice.
So I have spoken with TradeMe, and they have agreed to do that. So
how do you prove it by getting receipts or something from Red Cross from the people? Because at the moment it seems like a bit of an honesty box.
It is. You do have to get your refund of the success fee. Yep. You do actually have to provide TradeMe with the auction number and a receipt of the donation from the Red Cross when you donate online.
Hey, does that make it tax deductible?
I assume it does. I looked at it today. I couldn't quite figure out the law. I looked it up on IRD website, and it's sort of, I didn't really understand it exactly what was deductible. It sort of just ended up the ones, the item about having a housekeeper being tax deductible, and I was trying to figure out, oh, that sounds handy, but that's not what I was looking for.
I think that the donation, I think as long as it's anything over, there's a threshold of like $2 or $5.
No, it's $5. I saw that.
I think it's if the cash donation over that, I don't think it matters how they made the money. If it's from selling secondhand goods or whatever it's from, I think it's tax deductible if you donate over $5.
Yeah, I think before what the problem was is there were different percentages on how much you had donated.
Right.
Don't quote me on this, but it seemed to be there was a limit of how much money you could claim.
Yeah.
I think they're removing that to make it easier for companies to donate to charities.
No one here on Discourse is pretending, dear listener, to be your accountant. Speak to your accountant before you try and withhold any money from the IRD. Because in my experience, the IRD, really good guys. But I imagine that when you get on their bad side, they're not so good.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But definitely a good idea to keep your receipt. Because when you hand it in to the accountant at the end of the year, March, another month. And, hopefully you'll be able to get that money back expense that tax.
And I would say, dear listener, go and look in your goodie box. Maybe sell your TV. You don't need that. Maybe your old laptop, your old iPhone. You don't need that either.
I mean, yeah, exactly. There's one guy. There's an iPhone there already. There's a guy got his 3G iPhone on the site, and there's another guy's got his MacBook Pro.
Yeah.
If you're not using it, I think the rule is if you haven't used it in a year, get rid of it. Come on, put it on the site and sell it. And that's probably going to be the biggest contribution you can make to the people in Christchurch, the people that are really struggling at the moment.
Right. Yeah, they certainly are. I think I hope people don't lose sight of the fact that, it's still a disaster zone. They still have, no water, no sewerage, and, limited areas have even electricity.
Yeah, exactly. So my grandma's down there, they're 93, and her sister's there, she's 91, and then her partner's there, and she's 89. And they've got no water and no sewerage, so they've been flying out to Brisbane tomorrow morning, actually. Wow. But I think it's going to be a hard time for them coping in this without the facilities that are missing down in Christchurch.
Geez, John, you've got good genes. If the longevity of your grandparents say anything about yours, you're going to be around for a long time. Hopefully, having even more ideas like this one, listeners. Once again, it's garagesalechch.org.
Awesome,
John. Thank you so much for joining us.
Cheers, Morgan.
And at the time of recording, they are closing in on the $10,000 raised mark. And you can help out, and you should help out. Everything goes to Red Cross, which, is a pretty great cause. Just to get rid of a bunch of your old unwanted stuff, garagesalechch.org. Go on.
You're listening to Discourse.
Now we're going to speak with Natasha Markham about rebuilding Christchurch, a bit more, you know, forward-looking, a bit more positive and hopefully optimistic than, you know, the very grim reality of what everyone else is still dealing with. Natasha is an architect and urban designer who has worked in those fields, both in New Zealand and in the UK, in the private sector and for council. So you'll have some insight then on, you know, the longer-term reconstruction of Christchurch. What I'm worried about and what our earlier guest, Leighton Duncan, is worried about is that, I mean, Christchurch is the best example. It's considered, you know, quite an English city. And the reason for that is because it has all of those beautiful old, you know, the so-called heritage buildings, which both Auckland and Wellington, you know, we demolished them. We'd redeveloped most of them out of the way. So we didn't have them at all. We didn't have that amazing central city that Christchurch had. And now it seems like they're just all gone. And the ones that remain, I mean, Leighton is from that city. He had an office in a beautifully redeveloped 1920s warehouse. He doesn't want to be in a building like that again.
And because he is genuinely scared about that sort of building?
And rightly. I mean, it seems like they just don't stand up. Even the ones that were a bit strengthened just didn't really stand up.
Yeah, well, I mean, it certainly all of the reports seem to say that the it's the brick buildings that have tumbled.
That's right.
And yeah, I mean, I can totally understand his fear. I mean, they're beautiful buildings, some of them, but you know, if an event like that comes again, you wouldn't want to be anywhere near them.
And no one expected it to be Christchurch. I think everyone expected it to be Wellington.
Well, I think that's a really interesting thing because you know, in terms of designing for earthquakes and seismic strengthening, I mean, Wellington at the moment has perhaps the strictest rules with regards to that, but if we look at where earthquakes have occurred, you know, the large ones over the last sort of 100 years, I mean, Napier, Edgecombe, now Christchurch, yeah. I mean, it's pretty evident that this is something that almost all areas in New Zealand need to be thinking about. Yeah. And I think in that sense, there's some real lessons that can be learned from Christchurch and that we, you know, as we look forward, you know, as to how to go forward, it needs to be kind of a research-based move where we're really looking at ways that we can strengthen buildings, build cities, both new buildings and say that strengthening the old ones that do exist. Mm.
So, I mean, I'm sure everyone has been on the, well, maybe not everyone. I know I've been on the tour of Parliament buildings and been down into the basement to look at the the retrofitted shock absorbers. If you can do that kind of reconstruction, renovation of that kind of building, then I mean, surely you can manage something with smaller buildings.
I think so, but I think that you have to remember, you know, a building like the Parliament buildings are publicly owned. There is a real need, a real incentive, if you like, to put that kind of strengthening in. What you have in Christchurch was, say, buildings like the one that Leighton was in, privately owned buildings. You know, where are the economic incentives there for private owners to strengthen their buildings? Because at the moment, unless you're doing renovations over a certain scale, you just don't have to to upgrade them in that way.
Right. Something else that I know he mentioned being worried about is, I mean, he doesn't want to go back into these, you know, these heritage buildings, these old brick buildings, but he's also worried that the feel of the city, and in fact the city itself, will be killed if this redevelopment is not handled really well. If it's just, you know, developers going in there and very quickly doing the concrete tilt slab construction, and just, you know, replacing all of the now empty plots with just kind of garbage buildings, which maybe would be safer.
Well, I agree with him. I would worry about that as well. And I mean, I think that's that's why we have to be really careful in the way that we approach Christchurch. I mean, I think that if you look at applying an urban design process to the rebuilding of the city, then the first step is to assess what's there, assess, you know, what needs to be demolished, what could be strengthened, you know, what are the kind of the historic buildings there that we can build the city on and around, and then also look at the basic urban structure as well. Is it going to suit, you know, stand up to another earthquake event in the future? Do we need to widen streets and areas? Do we need to think about a different urban form? And then after that kind of assessment and analysis, then you move on to planning carefully and then implementation.
Being from Auckland, I know that we have consistently blown this forethought, this long-term planning in terms of, you know, urban design and you know, the sort of buildings that we've allowed, the sort of subdivisions that we've allowed. Auckland's a disaster. That's what my experience has been. So I don't have much confidence that we'll be able to prevent that from happening in Christchurch. How do you do it? Is it a legislation thing? I guess it's a council thing really, isn't it?
It's complex. There has to be the right statutory framework for it. And I think that what you have to remember is that there is an urban design protocol now in existence, which is a relatively new thing. We're just kind of getting to grips, I think, as a country, that with the fact that most of us do live in urban environments and that we can't allow them to just happen. We do need to provide some forethought and planning into them. So it's a very nascent discipline and interest, if you like, but I think that Christchurch provides a real opportunity to go about this in a much better way than we have in Auckland to date, for sure, and in other areas. And I think that we should be looking internationally to open up design competitions for key buildings and also to get our tertiary institutes, the relevant departments there, you know, in Christchurch, you know, looking at how we can learn from this, and also then what innovation can we then inject into the city. We have to really think about this in the big picture way. You know, I agree with you. We can't allow sort of, you know, bit by bit development that, you know, goes ahead and, you know, has no kind of cohesive idea about how it's going to work in the future.
Napier is only notable because it is so themed with deco. I mean, is there anything other than deco present, really? I know that my favourite building in Christchurch is also my favourite gallery in New Zealand. And also, I mean, the Christchurch Gallery is where they've now been housing civil defence headquarters because it survived so well. And that's one of the most modern and beautifully designed buildings in the city. Is it only beautiful, though, because it's across the road from the Art Centre, that kind of gothic old stone? I mean, I think it used to be the Canterbury University, didn't it? I mean, it even has an observatory and all that, all that beautiful old stuff. Do I only like the gallery because it is not... because the city is not all glass and steel?
Well, I think context, absolutely. And, you know, and kind of that juxtaposition of old and new gives a real richness to cities. And, you know, you can't just build that. I mean, it happens, it evolves over time. Yeah. But, you know, I it's really difficult to say at the moment, but I would imagine that there will be some buildings that can and totally should be salvaged. And it was interesting, I was listening to an interview with the director of the Canterbury Museum, and he was talking about the collections but also the building, and saying that at the moment, you know, from his sort of first appraisal, it seems that both have remained pretty well intact. So, you know, there are stories of hope as well amongst the stories of devastation. And, you know, I think any rebuilding of Christchurch is going to have to kind of hold on to those treasures and then look at the very careful complementary development around them, you know. And I think that good cities are made of, you know, very modern buildings as well. It's important that anything that is built that is new is of our time, that it's not some I don't know, nostalgic idea of what was.
Not wishing to add insult to injury, but I actually wouldn't mind if they had to bowl the Canterbury Museum, because I think it is an extremely disappointing museum, possibly the most disappointing museum in a major city in New Zealand.
Well, I'm not terribly familiar with the building, I have to say, but I was just listening to this interview on the radio. So
it looks lovely from the outside. It feels similar to the Art Centre, but the way their collection is presented is, I mean, this is a bit of a rat hole. This is kind of a useless aside, but I mean, the very first thing you see is sort of I want to call it a diorama, but it's life size, so it's,
all right.
It's not a diorama. And it feels so racist. It's you know, this savage kind of unevolved face of, you know, what they call a Maori warrior, but he looks like a Neanderthal. And it's like, are you kidding me?
it's a very Victorian presentation.
Yeah, it's bizarre. And it's the first thing that you see when you go in. But the people there were great. I'm sure they have wonderful items in their collections, but it didn't feel satisfying for me. As a fan of museums, I did not enjoy walking around inside the Canterbury Museum. So,
Hopefully the director will be listening and he can take a few pointers from that. Up your game.
Dear Canterbury director, Canterbury Museum director, I apologise. I'd love it if you'd come on the show and tell me off. But maybe also tell me that I was there on a bad day and it's not normally so stink. That wasn't a very good apology, was it? Now you say that you know, the ideal is for this reconstruction to be representative of our time. What is our time? What I think of as our time is unfortunately probably, you know, 15 years out of date. I think of those awful polystyrene buildings with sprayed on concrete, and, you know, all those horrible leaky buildings and appalling subdivisions made of a monoculture of horrid townhouses. I hope that is not of our time, and I hope that, you know, the beautiful buildings like the Christchurch Art Gallery are more of our time.
Well, I think both are of our time, really. But there's, you know, every era has its dross as well as its stars. Do you know what I mean? And so I think that if you look to some of the architecture that is being produced in New Zealand, there are some really great examples of modern architecture, buildings, urban developments being built right now. And I think that it's really, you know, we've only seen quite recently perhaps a greater skill in our approach to urban buildings, because we've traditionally always done really great houses, but city building requires a different process and a different approach. And it's only quite recently that we're starting to see good city buildings from local architects. And I think that's really encouraging.
I know that from where I am in central Auckland, if I look out my window from, as I mentioned, it's a late 20s, I guess it's partially deco building. If I look out my window, I can see just rubbish apartment buildings, and you know, without having been in most of them, they just look horrible, and they look like, you know, that sort of that shoebox style thing where, you know, a car park is probably larger than some of them, and I'm sure that the stud is, you know, just high enough that you don't hit the ceiling when you raise your hands to take off your shirt at the end of the day, and crappy lighting and ugly exteriors, and, you know, materials used on the outside chosen from a catalogue based probably on cost, maybe, you know, using the clone tool and whatever knockoff architecture design software they use just to, you know, layer up. Oh, no, we need 15 more floors. Well, let's just copy this one and throw
You're right on all of that. But you have to realise too that the most buildings in New Zealand, including a lot of the ones that you're talking about seeing out your window, are not designed by architects.
Yeah.
And then there have been buildings built in the city which are even, you know, perhaps designed by architects, but not designed by architects, you know, who are versed in city building.
Yeah.
So I think that the challenge for Christchurch is really to put, you know, to very clearly define the benchmark. And, I mean, you can do that through a lot of the policy documentation and so on that gets put around an urban plan. So, you know, when I talked about an assessment and then a plan, I'm not talking about just plans for buildings. I'm talking about a plan for the city. How do we move forward? What's the strategy? What's the physical design of these spaces? What should be the building envelopes? So you set a framework up in which architects then can operate and build. And, I mean, I think that, you know, there should be, you know, really stringent criteria about what gets put up. It shouldn't be just a kind of free-for-all, put it up as quick as possible. I mean, we're better to take a longer-term approach and go about it in a more methodical and thoughtful way. I think we owe it to Christchurch. We owe it to New Zealand.
Now, something that I... until this conversation actually came up a day or so ago, I didn't realise that Napier, they built temporary structures.
Yes, they did, like a tin town.
Right, and so that gave them the time to, you know, put the thought into and the, you know, the effort into crafting, you know, what we see as modern Napier. Is that something that's, is it conceivable that could be?
Well, I think so. I mean, it's difficult to get our heads around the scale of the problem at the moment because we're seeing these kind of images on TV and there's sort of rumours that maybe 30% of the buildings might have to be destroyed. But, you know, if that's the case, to put up a new building, you don't just put up a new building overnight. They're still going to have to go through resource consent projects and so on. So to me, it makes a lot of sense to try and relocate businesses that don't have to be in the CBD and then perhaps put up some kind of, I don't know, temporary tin town or whatever, to kind of keep some to keep businesses going, to give people a centre to go to. I don't know exactly how it can be done, but I think it's something that should be looked at for sure.
If only it happened to Auckland, and if only it happened only...
You're so scathing of your own city.
Yeah, I can't help it. If only it happened only at the port. Because, I mean, what is it going to take?
What a wonderful view we would have from our city. We'd actually realise that we live on a harbour rather than...
The waterfront we'd have, wouldn't it be wonderful? I mean, just walking around Wellington.
I mean, but I won't talk. We're not talking about Auckland, though. We're talking about Christchurch.
Auckland as a cautionary tale on what happens when you don't take this holistic urban design, city design, long-term view into account, I think. Hopefully Christchurch will learn that lesson. And maybe because it is so big, maybe they can actually do it. Maybe
Possible. I think that's right. And I actually think that we can't afford not to, you know, commit to this boots and all and say, okay, you know, we are going to make the Christchurch of the future a city where excellence in urban design, excellence in livability, sustainability. That's our benchmark. That's what we aim for. And, you know, I guess the other thing here is that we need to keep Christchurch alive in everybody's minds, both here and internationally. And I think that if we look at sort of promoting international design competitions, we kind of keep it alive in the consciousness. We are making moves then to restore confidence in the area, both for the people who live there and also for investors as well. Because, you know, as much as sort of John Key says, oh, well, we can rebuild it with the 14 billion, you know, obviously a lot of private investment will be required as well to rebuild the city.
I really like this idea of design competitions. I guess they're only as good as the submissions.
They're actually only as good as the brief. And, I mean, I think, you know, going back to Auckland again, we saw a very poorly run urban design competition for the Wharf. And then a mayor who said, oh, well, the quality of the entries aren't good enough. Well, I would say that the quality of the brief perhaps wasn't good enough. I mean, to get good answers, you have to ask the right questions. You have to frame the problem. And I think to date that we haven't done that very well in New Zealand.
What I would like to see, now this is about Auckland again, I want to see basically the equivalent of the Colossus on the waterfront standing astride our beautiful harbour. But I want it to be I can never remember the name of the sculpture. It used to be in the ASB building foyer, and now it's in Aotea Square, and it's a bronze of a Māori warrior with a patu. And I would just like to see that just kind of standing there, challenging the world, you know, in the form of all of our visitors, just vast, huge colossus on our waterfront. And I'm imagining, though, around the feet, maybe one of the legs can be in the water, but it's not just in the water. It's not just a monolithic structure, as well as being able to, you know, climb up inside it. Maybe one arm can be out, and it's possible for children and adventurous adults to climb out on their arm and launch themselves free into space to plunge into a free, once again, harbour, not surrounded by stinky container ships and, you know, 10 high stacks of cargo containers, but just kind of a park, a beautiful park, and this huge warrior standing astride saying, we're not going to let you fuck with our city anymore. We like our waterfront very much, and here we are, and it's ours forever.
Wow. I mean, I've often said we need a vision. That's kind of Stalin meets the Statue of Liberty.
Statue of Liberty is little by comparison. And I'm sure it's going to be built. No worries. You know, I sent it out to the universe. Now it's going to happen.
Yeah.
Oprah says that's all you need to do.
And what does Christchurch need then?
Well, that's an excellent question. I don't know that they can have my idea, because I want that for Auckland.
What do we do if we don't rebuild? I don't think we can abandon Christchurch. No. I mean, you can't just relocate a city. It's an incredible, you know, an important centre for all of Canterbury in terms of, you know, farmers and that kind of thing. I think you have to rebuild.
Yeah.
Do you do it in a kind of mediocre kind of business as usual way, or do you go, hey, this is an opportunity to make this, you know, absolutely a city of the 21st century, the 22nd century even, you know, let's make it sustainable. Let's look at alternative energy sources. You know, how do we do better? Well, let's make this an exemplar for urban living for the world.
Something that came out of Webstock is the need for dictators. And if you look at the one company that everybody will almost certainly think of when you say, who is doing design right? Who is getting aesthetics right? Who is taking the user most into account? Most people will say it's Apple. And,
yeah, absolutely.
And you'd also say that clearly that is because they have one guiding vision coming from the top, who is paying attention to the details, and it's making sure that everyone else does as well. And so I think, as you say, if we pussyfoot around, it's going to suck. The developers need to have guidance. The architects need to have guidance. And so, as you mentioned, you know, the brief is important. And so putting thought into what, you know, what is the future of Christchurch? How do the people of, I mean, I'm an Aucklander. It's not up to me what they have. What do the people of Christchurch want? And I think what they want is a beautiful, livable city that is attractive to visitors and is nice for locals to live in as well. I'm pretty sure not very many people will disagree with that.
No, I mean, I think most of us want that, actually.
Yeah, I'd like it for Auckland. Thank you so much for joining us on the show.
My pleasure. It's been fun.
And thanks once again to Natasha and all of our other guests this week. I know this is a bit of a change in tone for the Discourse Weekly show, and hopefully, beloved listener, you're not suffering from Christchurch fatigue, because if you are, you're in for really bad news. John Key said today that he expects it's going to take 15 years to rebuild the city, and that people won't even start to move back into the CBD for months. This is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a short story. Christchurch are going to need our help and care for a long time to come. As always, you can check the site for the show notes, or if you have feedback, send email to comments@discourse.co.nz, or hit the talkback page on the site with any questions or comments, or if you have an idea for a guest, or even if there's something you'd like to speak about on Discourse yourself. If you're really clever, you can send us an MP3 with your comments and we'll play it next time. Or, and as you and I know, this is the only thing you'll do, just talk about it on Twitter. And please tell a friend. Next week, perhaps, we'll run the WordCamp live show we recorded in Wellington in February, and which I promised you this week. But who knows? Maybe I'll play it next week. Maybe I'll keep it up my sleeve. Keep things exciting, eh? Goodbye, Internet. Thank you for listening.
You're listening to the weekly show on of course.
All right, we're using that one.